Madam President, I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant-at-Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye. All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Sergeant-at-Arms will bring in the absent members. Today's chaplain is the Reverend Cindy Rasmussen from Asbury United Methodist Church in Duluth and the personal pastor of Senator Roger Reinert.
Let us pray. O Holy One, you are like a weaver in our lives. Out of the expanding energy of creation, you have spun each of us with our own special hue and texture. We are members of the human family. We belong to the crowd, yet each is alone. We are the poor and the rich, the hungry and the satisfied. Sometimes we leap, weep, and sometimes we laugh. Trusting in your care, we lift up to you all our concerns, and we pray for this world in which we live. We pray that you pour out your spirit wherever life is broken. Pour out your spirit wherever life groans to be made new. Pour out your spirit and begin your work of healing. When we have lost our vision, where our dreams have grown small and hopes have disappeared, breathe on us again. As persons with varieties of gifts called to serve the world, may our work enrich our common life. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice.
The secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Benson, Bonoff, Brown, Carlson, Chamberlain, Champion, Clausen, Cohen, Dahl, Dames, Dibble, Dietzick, Eaton, Eakin, Fischbach, Franzen, Gazelka, Goodwin, Hall, Han, Herr, Hayden, Hoffman, Housley, Ingebrigtsen, Jensen, Johnson, Kent, Kiffmeyer, Kunin, Latz, Limmer, Lori, Marty, Metzen, Miller, Nelson, Newman, Nino, Ortman, Osmick, Pappas, Peterson J, Peterson B, Pratt, Reinert, Rest, Rosen, Rood, Saxhog, Scalzi, Schmidt, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Sparks, Stumpf, Thompson, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Weber, Westrom, Wieger, and Wickland.
A quorum is present. Third order of business, messages from the House. The Secretary will read the message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce that the House has adopted the recommendations and report of the Conference Committee on House File Number 5 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. House File Number 5, a bill for an act relating to commerce, establishing the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, prescribing its powers and duties. House File Number 5 is herewith transmitted to the Senate. Albin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
Senator Bach.
Madam President, I'd like to impose a call of the Senate for the remainder of the proceedings on the Conference Committee report on House File Number 5.
The Senate is under call.
I move that further proceedings on the roll call be dispensed with and the sergeant at arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Sergeant of Arms will be instructed to bring in the absent members. Senator Laurie. A third order of business, messages from the House. The Secretary will read the message.
Oh, you did read?
Senator Laurie.
Madam President, I move that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report on House File 5 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
Senator Laurie. Senator Benson.
Madam President, I request a roll call, and before we take this vote, could Senator Laurie please explain any difference, any provisions in the bill that were not in House and Senate reports?
Roll call has been requested. I think Senator Laurie was about to do that.
Madam President, Senator Benson, yes, thank you. I was going to go into a brief description of the changes that occurred during the conference committee process and step members through that. Largely, just to give you a heads up, there were three fairly significant pieces of this bill which we were out of sync on between the House and the Senate. Those are financing, smart purchasing authority, active purchaser, if you will, and rulemaking. And so I will save those for last and cover most of the balance of the bill, which is 85-90% of the language. And there were some differences that we worked out rather early in the process. The House had done significant work on data practices, had a bipartisan team, including members from both parties, Mary Liz Holberg, Steve Simon, Winkler, Representative Winkler primarily, spent about 5 hours going over the data processing, data practices piece of this bill, and had really done some excellent work, and counsel from both bodies agreed that that was probably superior to the work that had been done in the Senate, and so we took the House's data practices language. There was a piece added to the bill regarding making sure that the goals of the marketplace include promoting informed consumer choice. The Senate took that provision. The House had some more explicit requirements of the Office of the Legislative Auditor mandating reports every year and suggesting that the marketplace actually pay for the audits conducted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We thought that that would be acceptable as well and additional oversight. The open appointments process, this was a piece that was in neither the House nor the Senate bill when we went in, but the governor had requested that we take a look at the first year of appointments to this board and actually subject them to the open appointments process. When we first crafted this bill, it was assumed that we would not have time to go through the open appointments process for the initial creation of this board, but the governor, in working with the Secretary of State, has determined that they can make it through that, and it does add openness and accountability and transparency and statewide publication of the board positions available that should help make sure that we have an expert board appointed. So we added open appointments process applicability to the first year of appointments. The House also had some language regarding continuous operation of a private marketplace, basically restating things that we'd already talked about in the Senate, just that we really do intend for there to be a competitive market still existing outside of the exchange. And we accepted that language. We did a significant amount of conversation and work regarding conflicts of interest and recusal. We worked on the conflict as regards a provider for quite some time. As we got into the conference committee process, it became apparent that the University of Minnesota primarily actually does own and operate a hospital and would have been excluded in their entirety in the manner in which we had the conflict of interest initially drafted. And so we had a long talk about that. What we wound up doing was saying that the conflict applied to an institutional provider of health care, but that an institutional provider of health care does not include an educational facility. The House had a specific prohibition from a board member being a registered lobbyist. We took that as well. And we had, because now we have some providers that could come in and be have a conflict of interest, the House also had crafted some strong recusal language requiring that if a board member does have a conflict that arises, they would recuse themselves from the conversation and the vote regarding that item with which they had a conflict. The Senate also had prohibition, extended the conflict of interest to close family members for health carriers, health insurance carriers, and that meant spouses, parents, and children. That did seem a bit broad. We restricted it to spouses only. And that brings us to the three larger items, which were financing, active purchaser, and rulemaking. I'll start with the rulemaking. The Senate, we went over this quite a bit. The Senate had a 21-day rulemaking provision for the first year of operation of the exchange to provide that nimbleness to get up and running and make sure that they were able to function appropriately in this changing marketplace. But due to open, accountable operations of public entities, due process concerns, we, after that first year, thought that it would be wise to go to the well-defined expedited rulemaking under Chapter 14, which is typically a six-month process to promulgate rules. The House came in with a quite different provision requiring essentially a rulemaking process similar to our 21-day but calling for 30 days, and they ran that forever. And the Senate really felt that that didn't give the openness and accountability to this board and the due respect for due process concerns. And so we went round and round about this. Where we wound up was the Senate's 21-day rulemaking provision. Instead of for 1 year, we run that for 2 years. And with that, we added a bit of additional oversight that I think in the end is going to be incredibly valuable. The Legislative Advisory Committee that was a Senate-only provision was adopted, and this Legislative Advisory Committee is given the ability in the Conference Committee report to review the rules and stop them from being effective, postpone them from being effective until the legislature has a chance to take a look at the rules and make sure that they are in sync with what we expected and what we were looking for from this board. So that's the rulemaking piece. The financing, there's been a lot of talk about this. The House went in with the up to 3.5% withhold from day one and forward. The Senate had changed that to a certified expenditure and transferred from the health impact fee. In conversations around that, we wound up working on a process by which we could get the first year of operations funding at about a third of what the federal level was, about a third of the initial proposed expense. We are allowing a 1.5% withhold from plans sold through the marketplace for the first year of financing, and the ability for the exchange to take a loan from the special revenue fund to make sure that they're able to get up and running, but they will have to pay back that loan within the first biennium with interest. On smart purchasing authority, active purchaser, the Senate came in with, and we talked about this for a long time as well, the Senate came in with year two authority for the board to select plans that were deemed in the interest of consumers. And in order to get there, the exchange would have to promulgate rules by February 1st of each year that talked about the criteria that they would use to evaluate those plans and the specific measurements against which those criteria would be evaluated in making the determination, and importantly, gave the carriers access to a robust appeals process, contested case hearing immediately if they felt they had been wrongly excluded. The House had largely gutted the active purchaser, so we had quite a bit of work to do there. What we, and the Senate also had significant ability to ensure that the plans in 2014, the first year of operations, were also in the interest of consumers. We had put in what I felt was a reasonable set of criteria that the board could use to determine in the interest of consumers, but there was significant pushback, and at the end of the day, the carrier's biggest ask towards the end of the conference committee as we were closing it up was that we allow the federal exchange basically requirements and Minnesota's historic HMO standards to guarantee them access to the exchange. And so for year one, carriers that put together plans that meet Minnesota's historic HMO standards and the federal minimum requirements will be guaranteed access to the exchange in order to sell their products. This was a significant give, but beyond that, essentially the Senate's active purchasing authority remained intact beginning January 1, 2015 and forward. That is a summary of the changes made during the conference committee process, and I would encourage members' support in accepting the conference committee report. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Lurie, I do have a question about page 13, beginning with line 1, sections 3 and 4, appear to be new language. Were those in the House bill?
Senator Lurie.
I'm sorry, Madam President. I didn't ask Senator Lurie to yield. If he will yield, I would appreciate an
Senator
answer
Senator Lurie,
to
will
question.
You yield? Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Lurie on the question.
Senator Benson, I'm on page 13. Which line numbers again?
Senator Benson.
I have beginning with line 1, sections 3 and 4.
Yes.
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Benson, this is in regards to health carriers and health plan requirements for participation. The marketplace can, in their determination of in the interest of consumers, again, similar to the Senate language, we did add paragraphs 3 and 4 there, that the health carrier applying to offer health plans through the marketplace also has to offer health plans at each actuarial value level and service area that the health carrier currently offers health plans in. So you can't dump a whole bunch of your small group or individual markets as well. That would yield a situation where you could game the system and focus on specific markets, even despite the fact that you had served additional markets historically. And the health carrier, paragraph 4, does not apply to offer health plans in the individual and small group markets through the marketplace under a separate license of a parent organization. So you can't try to offer one set of plans as a carrier outside the market and a separate set of plans by gaming the system and developing different plans under subsidiaries.
Are there any other questions?
Madam President, if
Senator Benson.
If I could follow up with Senator Lurie, ask specifically if those were House provisions. Could you please tell me where they were in the House Senate file or House File 5?
Senator Lurie.
I can go dig into the House provisions, but these were in the House bill. I don't have the page in line, but they were in the reviser side by side, and the House thought these did add a lot to make sure that the plans offered are in the interest of consumers. So yes, these were in the House bill.
Senator Hahn, any other questions?
Madam President.
Senator Benson.
The sections 3 and 4 appear to try to control health insurance products outside of the exchange by dictating what could be offered. And that is not the purpose of this legislation, Senator Lurie. If he would yield, was that discussed in conference committee?
Senator Lurie.
Could you repeat the question, Senator Benson?
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Lurie. The purpose of House File 5, Senate File 1, was to establish the Minnesota insurance marketplace, not to regulate care, not to regulate insurance products offered outside of the exchange. These both have a significant impact on products offered outside the exchange. Was that discussed on your conference committee?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, paragraph 3 is regarding health plans at each actuarial level and service area that the health carrier currently offers in the individual and small group markets, and section 4 is regarding the requirement that plans not split their markets under different subsidiaries. And so to the extent that it operates outside the exchange, it's only in the case that a carrier is trying to game the system. We don't actually expect this to occur, but these were in the House bill and were an important provision to the House in terms of making this compromise between the House and the Senate work. And so we did have conversations about these, yes.
Okay, and thank you, Madam President. If Senator
Benson
will yield for another question. Do you
Benson.
A letter or some communication from the governor requesting a change to the open appointments process?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, I do not have a letter or a document, but I sat across the table myself from the governor, and he asked me that we consider adopting that change to the open appointments process, and I received absolutely no feedback. I mean, it's the open appointments process. It'll be published broadly. It'll be a better process. The only reason we went in exempting it is because we had been under the understanding that they could not meet the timeline. So, I mean, this was additional oversight and accountability and openness and transparency to make sure that the appointments are as good as possible. So this was not a controversial amendment tried to slip in at the end of the day, but no, I did not ask the governor to put it in writing that we subject the first year to the open appointments
process. Senator Gazelka.
I didn't feel it was necessary.
Madam President, is Senator Benson done? I don't want to interrupt.
I don't know. I called on you.
Okay. Thank you. Will Senator Lurie yield?
Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Lurie, I know before session you had a number of business advocates, Minnesota Chamber, NFIB, and others, all advocating for a Minnesota exchange. They felt like that was the best direction to go, and yet now none of them support the Minnesota exchange that you have crafted here, and I just want to know if that concerns you, and I'd like some comments from you on that.
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Gazelka, you know, I wish that we could have brought more of them along. I will say this. I've had a lot of comments throughout the process from a lot of these groups saying that they really, really, really want a Minnesota-based exchange. And yet over the last, you know, the Affordable Care Act has been in law for 3 years. And we've had several proposals before the legislature regarding an exchange. And there has not been one that has garnered the support of these groups. And so at some point you have to ask, how much do they really want a Minnesota-based exchange? Where is their plan? What is it exactly that they support? I have yet to see it. I'd be interested in seeing it. I've had them throw rocks at everything that's been proposed, and they have concerns with everything, but I have yet to see exactly that marketplace that they would support.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Lurie yield, please?
Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Senator Lurie, I'm particularly concerned about subsection 4, that'd be page 13.4 through 13.8. And I'd like you to explain what the intent of this section of legislation is. What is this section driving to? What are you trying to accomplish with this new section? And I do believe it's new language that we did not have in the Senate, and perhaps new language that wasn't even in the House report. But I'd like to know, what's the intent? What are you trying to drive at here?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, despite the fact that I already said that this was actually in the House bill, I have now found the reference. Points 3 and 4 here were in paragraph C and D of subdivision 6 of section 6 on page R16 of the reviser side by side, page 12 of the reviser side by side of the House file. The paragraph itself is actually rather self-explanatory. If one were to read it, it's that a health carrier can't break up their book of business and organize under sub carriers and put different products inside the marketplace than outside the marketplace in order to take advantage and create a situation of adverse selection against the exchange.
Madam President.
Senator Gazelka. Actually, I got distracted. I think Senator Benson was next in line. Senator Benson.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, for what purpose does the lady rise?
I asked Senator Lori. I was not finished.
I apologize, Senator Nelson. I'm just trying to spread the questions around, and there are three people standing. So, all right, we'll go back to Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Madam President. Well, Senator Lori, I did read the language. No, I did not see it before because it was not in the Senate, and it did come from the House. But what I understand you to say is that the very same active purchaser method that is so concerning to many of us, according to this language, will be extended to the insurance market that is not in the exchange. And let me add, I understood Senator Lori to say that he's not heard from anybody about what should be in the exchange. And I will say we had an 11.5-hour debate on this floor about that. I sent a 2-page letter to all conferees, a bipartisan letter with 28 signatures from senators on this floor who talk specifically about what the legislation should look like. It should be an all-comers market in the exchange. People, plans that meet the criteria designed by the board and the feds should be able to offer their products. And now, with the insertion of lines 13.4 through 13.8, it appears that the bill that has come back from conference committee is even worse, because now it's going to take what is offered on the exchange, anything must also be, those same plans offered outside the exchange must also conform to those same rules. So I believe this is actually a step backwards. I was sincerely hoping that the bill that came back from conference committee would be one that truly was an exchange that was good for Minnesotans, that would keep consumer choice and more competition, and with the insertion of this language, it appears to me that there will be less choice and less competition, which certainly will not lower costs.
Madam President.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I had microphone problems here, but I was in a conversation with Senator Lori and asked him to yield and wanted to respond back. Senator Lori had asked or had responded that he wanted more business participation and wasn't sure what they really wanted in the bill. And there was a number of things that they all made clear that were very important for them to have enthusiastic support. One was they didn't want to be automatically excluded if four members of a board decided that they just felt like they wouldn't be in there. Number two, they wanted participation in the board, that they would have a voice among many voices so that people would understand their perspective because they were bringing that too. Number three, they did not want a premium tax, which taxed a limited group of people that need health insurance, and they didn't get any of those. And that's why the only group that I know of that supports this is, I believe they're called Small Business Minnesota, that have 100 members, unlike the NFIB that has 13,000 and the Minnesota Chamber many. And so that's why they did not want to participate, when in the beginning they wanted to participate. They wanted a Minnesota exchange. But in the end, we're going to have something that has less input, more expensive, less choice for the consumer, more data shared that they don't want shared, and little oversight. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank Thank you, Madam President. Senator Lurie, I actually looked at R16. The language from the House side is significantly different than what has ended up in the final bill, which leads me to believe that it was neither truly in the House nor the Senate. It was created in conference committee, which is not what a conference committee is supposed to do. And so given that, I'm going to move to the recommendation of conference committee report on House File 5 be rejected and the bill be referred to the conference committee as formally constituted for further consideration. And I'd ask a roll call on that.
Roll call has been requested. Senator Benson moved that the recommendations and conference committee report on House File be rejected, the bill be referred to the conference committee as formally constituted for further consideration. Is there any discussion on that motion? Senator Limmer.
Madam President, thank you. Would the author yield for a question?
Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Lurie, a number of provisions that were adopted on the floor of the Senate as it was being passed out to conference committee are now not included in the bill. Some of those that I personally was involved in that you had accepted as friendly amendments, you might recall there were a couple of them on data privacy. There are some provisions that stated that in the event that Minnesota law was in conflict with federal law when it comes to data privacy protection, that we would adopt the Minnesota standard. Quite often the Minnesota standard is more protective than the federal law. A provision that we're allowed to write in our state statutes. So could you tell me why that is not in the bill? And that's one question, Madam President.
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Limmer, as I stated in my introductory remarks, the House had about 5 hours of subcommittee work on a bipartisan basis to work through the data practices issues. And we, with the advice of counsel, looking at the House work that had been done, felt that it was a more comprehensive addressing of the data practices concerns, and the House felt that anything that didn't come out of that work group that they assigned and built and accepted the entirety of their recommendations would be unacceptable to them. And so I did offer several amendments to try to get some of the amendments that you offered on the House floor, on the Senate floor, and that I accepted as friendly amendments incorporated into the bill. But the House was unwilling to do that. And I do think, you know, I'm willing to step through the key differences in the data practices if that would help. And I think it might. But I take a few minutes. I'd leave it to Senator Limmer if he'd like me to do that.
Senator Limmer.
Madam President, thank you. Senator Lurie, I would like to have an explanation of the data privacy provisions in the proposal before us. Before we do that, there was one requirement that you had accepted in the form of one of my amendments, that any member of the board had to at least be a resident of the state of Minnesota. After all, it is a Minnesota exchange board, and I was wondering if even that was still in the bill. And then I would also like to hear the explanation of what the privacy protections would be for the people in our state.
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, the resident of Minnesota, I believe, did survive Senator Limmer. Yes, on page 6.7 and line 6.7 and 6.8, all board members appointed by the governor must be legal residents of Minnesota. So that one did survive Senator Limmer. Stepping through the key differences between Senate File 1 and House File 5 data practices, again, most of which was we adopted the House position. But the open meeting law is one place where the House language restricts when meetings can be closed and subjects closed meetings to current standards under Chapter 13.03. We felt that was actually a significant improvement over the Senate. This is and that public records of closed meetings must be kept, et cetera. That's what you'll find under 1303. So we've done this work before. in regards to open meeting law and relied on some of the historic work that's been done in the legislature. As far as data practices generally, the House language is the product of 3-hour hearing in civil law and 2-hour hearing in the House Data Practices Subcommittee, where this group, Mary Liz Holberg, Steve Simon, Ryan Winkler, representatives, sat down and really did some good work on this. The House language restructures the data practices section to better fit within the data practices statute. And the House language, far more specific and generally, restricts sharing of data by the marketplace for very specific functions that the marketplace must carry out. To those specifics, data on the following individuals is private data: data on any individual participating in the marketplace, data on any individuals participating in the marketplace as employees of an employer participating in the marketplace, and data on employers participating in the marketplace. Data on entities seeking certification as an in-person assister, navigator, or insurance producer are private data until a determination is made by the marketplace, at which point the data is then public. This one is actually a key one that gets to some of the discussions that we had in a way that was a little different, but data sharing authority allowed only to the extent necessary to verify the identity of, determine the eligibility of, process premiums for, process enrollment of, or investigate fraud related to an individual, employer, or employee participating in the market. So that's the additional restrictions on the data sharing authority that gets to one of the points that you were trying to get at. The marketplace must have a data sharing agreement with any entity with which the marketplace shares data. That was in both bodies, but the House had a little different framing that was more specific. Other state agencies must share data with the marketplace only until July 1 of 2014. The Senate language did not have a time limit on that. The marketplace may create summary data consistent with Minnesota Statute 1305 sub 7 that we both had. The section further states that employees with only specific authorization may access data and that an audit trail must be created and maintained and the audit trail must be publicly available for access. The board shall immediately and permanently revoke the authorization of any individual determined to have willfully entered, updated, accessed, shared, or disseminated data in violation of this section or any provision of Chapter 13. And if an individual is determined to have willfully gained access to data without explicit authorization from the board shall forward the matter to the county attorney for prosecution. That was another one that we discussed on the floor. And it broadly prohibits the sale of any data created or maintained by the marketplace for any reason. And one more crops up, too, that there was a little bit of discussion about. The House also had a prohibition of the marketplace collecting any data regarding gun ownership and use. And we accepted that provision as well. So essentially, the marketplace is required to limit access to private data to only those individuals and entities with specific authorization from the board, and the board is required to limit that access based on the role of that individual authorized. So those are additional significant specifics around data practices that collectively, as conferees and Senate counsel, agreed was a more sophisticated approach than what the Senate came in with. And so with that, we adopted the House provisions, and then when I tried to add to them through amendment, the House thought that if this group that worked so long and hard didn't come up with these issues that I was raising and that you and I talked about on the Senate floor, that it was probably for a reason and it may conflict with the way they crafted this in the data practices statute, and they were incredibly resistant to accepting any of those amendments. And so I believe that we have a pretty good product here as regards data practices, as does the House.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you. And if Senator Lurie would answer a question.
Senator Lurie, will you yield? Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Hahn.
Just briefly, one of the provisions that was amended on the bill in the Senate floor debate was the provision that required members of the legislature to participate in the exchange. I believe that was removed. Could you confirm that? And if it was, could you give us the explanation of why that provision was removed?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Hamm, that provision was removed. It would actually be in conflict with the Affordable Care Act. We would not, well, certainly with the ability to draw down premiums. I mean, it's possible that we could send legislators out to shop on the exchange, but we could not get advanced premium tax credits or cost-sharing reductions regardless of our income because we have an employer with too many employees here. And so the House would not accept that provision either.
Is there any more discussion? Senator Benson.
Madam President, to that point, we could exempt ourselves from Section 49, and we could have been put into the exchange as individuals not covered by an employer plan. And so I just wanted to clarify that it is possible for us to have been put in the exchange without violating state law.
Is there any more discussion on the Benson motion? Senator Westrum.
Madam President, I'm wondering if the author, Senator Lurie, would yield for some
questions. Senator Lurie, will you yield? Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Westrum.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, I understand we've now got a 3.5% premium tax built into this bill. That was sort of what the House was doing to fund it, but we've now got a new hybrid of language that says 1.5% for the first year and $20 million appropriation from the general fund. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me where that language came from? Was it the House bill or the Senate bill?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrum, you know, the financing was an open issue between the House and the Senate, significant differences. One of the concerns that we were trying to work on was making sure that we were as efficient as possible with public dollars. You are correct. Year one is a up to 1.5% withhold, with up to a $20 million loan from the special revenue account, which is actually kind of a standard operating procedure in our special revenue accounts. This is where we do a lot of fee-based activity, and when we generate a new fund within the special revenue account, it's often assumed that it'll take some time for this activity or function to be self-sustaining, and so we allow it to run a deficit for a period. The period that we allow the exchange to run a deficit for is that they have to be done with that loan and pay it back with interest by the close of the biennium under that maximum of a $20 million loan that would be overseen by the Commissioner of Management and Budget. And with that, we were able to drive the withhold in year one to fund operating costs and startup costs and get an initial reserve going down to from 3.5% down to a maximum of a 1.5% withhold for the first year. This was thought to be very significant by both the House and the Senate, and it is within the realm of the differences in the financing mechanisms between the two bodies and an enhancement above either one.
Senator Westrum.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, thank you for that explanation. The second part of the question, Madam President, if Senator Lurie would yield.
Senator Lurie will yield. Senator Westrum.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, was this language in the House bill or the Senate bill, or did the conference committee come up with it on their own?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrum, the House and the Senate, again, were far apart on financing. The Senate wasn't willing to take the House's language in its entirety. The House wasn't willing to take the Senate's language in its entirety. We needed to keep working. We did. We sat down and we found a way to reduce that year one costs. We adopted it in the conference committee report. It did not exist in that exact fashion coming in from either body, but in the spirit of negotiations and of compromise, we felt it valuable to drive that first year down, and we were otherwise at loggerheads.
Senator Gazelka.
Madam President.
Senator Westrum.
I'm not done asking questions, if I can continue.
Please proceed. I'll try to take you one at a time.
I'll sit down when I'm done, Madam President, if that helps indicate. Madam President, Senator Laurie, thank you for that answer. Maybe a follow-up question to that, Madam President, if you would yield.
Senator Laurie, Senator Westrom.
Then I have a question on the funding and who's going to be taxed. Senator Laurie, is that what you said is the conference committee came up with the language. Is that what rule in the Senate gives the conference committee authority to do that? Could you cite that rule for me? Because I've always been under the impression and aware that the rules say they have to adopt language from one conference committee, one bill or the other. They can't come up with new language that hasn't passed the House or Senate. But can you tell us what rule gives the conference committee the right to develop new language?
Senator Laurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrom, you know, to get to the specific rule, I would probably need some help, but this is well within the standard history and tradition of how we conduct conference committees. This is what we do. We have differing provisions coming in, and we sit down and we negotiate. There's five from the House, five from the Senate. Neither provision was acceptable to the other body, and we needed to sit down and come up with something that was. And that's what we do in conference committee, and sometimes the language needs to change in order to accommodate the compromise that's struck in conference committee. Were it the case that only language specifically within one body or the other were able to come forward in conference committee, we would have an entirely unworkable process. What we have here is a compromise where the Senate accepted year two and beyond of the House financing mechanism, and we were able to carefully craft a manner to bring the first year operational costs down significantly from 3.5% to a 1.5% withhold on premiums sold within the exchange.
More, Senator Westrom.
Madam President, thank you, Senator Laurie. We could just go to having conference committees write the bills rather than have a body pass them separately ahead of time if we wanted to just do that. We don't have a designed process here that's supposed to be fast or expedient. It's supposed to be slow and deliberative by nature of our forefathers who designed this process because usually when we pass legislation, Madam President, it's limiting or it's potentially taxing or limiting freedoms or rights of citizens. And so that's why our forefathers have given us this design. But be that as it may, Madam President, a question for Senator Laurie, if he would yield on the tax.
Senator Laurie, will you yield? Senator Laurie will yield. Senator Westrom.
Madam President, Senator Laurie, I want to understand who's going to be taxed under this. There's a 3.5% premium tax after year one that's going to be charged. Now, I'm going to recap some of my understanding, but if you could fill in the gaps for myself and other senators here and other folks listening, there's a 3.5% tax on the premiums of the policies sold through the exchange, as I understand it. Those same products have to be sold for a comparable price outside the exchange. Are those products outside the exchange also going to be subject to a 3.5% tax, either hidden or separate line item? Or how does this tax affect and who pays it, if you could answer that question?
Senator Laurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrom, thank you for the question. This is the financing mechanism that carried through the policy committees of the Senate. It wasn't until we got to the tax committee. So we've described it a few times, but I'm happy to do so again on the floor here today. The way it works is it is a up to 3.5% withhold on policies sold through the exchange. It's important to note that the worst case scenario in the fiscal note calls for a withhold of closer to and a little bit below 3% of the withhold is what it's expected to take. Best case scenario is much better than that and can drive down below 2% if enrollment goes well. That said, It is true that the policies have to be the same. The prices on policies have to be the same inside and outside the exchange, and that with the 3.5 up to 3.5%, closer to 3% withhold on policies sold in the exchange, the carrier will have to cost allocate the costs across their entire book of business. It's important to note that many of the functions of the exchange will lessen the administrative burden of carriers trying to sell their plans of outreach and information to individuals and marketing and getting their products in front of people to consider purchase. Those are costs that will occur for plans sold outside the exchange, and those costs outside the exchange will also have to be cost allocated across the entire book of business. So it is not the case that the entirety of this withhold will be experienced outside the exchange. It is that all costs for a similar product sold inside and outside the exchange will have to be cost allocated based on the number of people and who they are and where they are purchasing this product. So those will have to be worked out through the rate setting process, through the Department of Commerce. The rate filings will have to take a close look at the manner in which these costs are cost allocated, but it will not be a withhold of anything near. It won't be a withhold at all outside the exchange, and it won't be a cost driver outside the exchange of anything near what the withhold is inside the exchange.
Senator Westrom.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, if you could expand on that, if you would continue to yield.
Senator Lurie, Senator Westrom.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, explain that a little more. You just said the cost driver of the 3.5 or whatever the 3.5% in the exchange won't be the same outside the exchange. Could you explain that a little more to us? Because we're requiring now the products to be sold at a comparable price outside of the exchange. Wouldn't you be driving up the cost of the products outside of the exchange so they can match what's being sold inside the exchange? Or can you explain that a little more?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrom, it depends on the cost allocation that the carriers derive for the product sold. It is true, as you stated, that the price for these products will have to be the same inside and outside the exchange. That's an Affordable Care Act, a federal requirement under the Affordable Care Act. And they need to do their own cost allocations about how these go. We heard testimony over and over again that the functions undertaken by the exchange are duplicative of functions that occur on the market today. Well, and I can accept that. There's a lot of the marketing and the outreach and the education of consumers that the exchange will be taking on, and they don't need to be duplicated within the exchange. And so costs incurred by carriers will be lower for products sold on the exchange than they will be for products sold outside the exchange. So they'll have to incur some of those costs outside the exchange. We've put a name on the costs inside, and we've said it's up to 3.5% withhold to cover those functions of the exchange. But we don't know what they'll be outside the exchange. They'll need to calculate those. Those will have to be in the rate filings that they submit to the Department of Commerce. And in either case, the costs incurred inside the exchange and the costs incurred outside the exchange will have to be cost allocated and spread across the entirety of the market to ensure that the prices are the same inside and outside the exchange.
Madam President, thank you.
Senator Lurie.
So who is going to have to be buying products under this exchange and who doesn't buy under the exchange? If you could clarify that for us as we're deciding whether we should send this back to conference or not. What I understand is small businesses, 50 or less employees, would actually need to steer their purchasing to the exchange. And if they don't, there would be a penalty that would increase year after year that they don't purchase from the exchange. But businesses with over 50 employees would stay by buying their product in the private market Is that correct, Senator Lurie? And are we now going to force all the small businesses and families out there to buy through this exchange that has this 3.5% premium tax?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrum, that is absolutely incorrect. Participation in the exchange by individuals, participation in the exchange by small businesses, participation in the exchange by the employees of larger businesses is all optional. It is never mandatory. Small businesses under 50 are able to get, many of them are able to get significant tax credits to help finance the health insurance products that they're making available to their employees. And one of the big benefits to small businesses of operating the exchange in this Minnesota way is that we've done a lot of work to try to bring about the ability to breathe some life into the defined contribution market so that small employers can know and set what the cost sharing that they are willing to participate in for their employees' plans will be. So no, it is not the case that we're mandating that anybody come to the exchange. It is entirely voluntary at all times.
Senator Westrum.
Senator Lurie, maybe I should just ask this question. Who is going to be buying from the exchange? And what you said now, there is no penalty for somebody not buying through the exchange if they don't want to. But who's going to be buying through this exchange then and subject to this premium tax?
Senator Lurie.
Senator, Madam President, Senator Westrum, there is no penalty ever for not participating in the exchange. There is a penalty for not having health coverage, but you have your own ability to choose where that health coverage is. There's affordability requirements. If you are an employer above 50 and you don't offer affordable health coverage and some of your employees come through the exchange and get tax credits, and this is not Senate File 1, this is the Affordable Care Act. Again, it's always important that we make this distinction. But if you are that type of employer, then the penalties do kick in for employers. But if you offer affordable coverage for your employees outside of the exchange, that is still your prerogative, and you're fully able to do that, and you will not incur any penalties as a result of not coming through the exchange to offer your products. In 2016, there is expected to be 1.3 million Minnesotans shopping for and finding the product that best meets their needs through the exchange. About 700,000 of those are expected to be Medicaid enrollees. I think about 450,000 are expected to be individuals, and 150,000, if memory serves, are expected to be employees of small employers.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Westrum.
Or Madam President, sorry. Madam President, at least for this round. Madam President, Senator Lurie, you talked about who's being covered. My understanding is Minnesota Care and medical assistance is going to be part of this. How is that going to work? And will we continue to have Minnesota Care in this state as we know it? Will that be rolled into something else? How does that exactly work under this system? Is that just another product that citizens can buy as one of the insurance products they would have for health care coverage, and that would qualify to avoid the penalty or the fine from the federal government if they have Minnesota Care? Is that going under this, and can you explain that to me and anybody else that maybe doesn't know that exactly?
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrum, it's a good question. Medicaid, of course, has different federal poverty guideline thresholds now. We've expanded it to 138% of federal poverty. There's also a new eligibility determination for how to calculate that. It's the MAGI standard. Other than that, Medicaid is similar. Minnesota Care, we on a bipartisan basis, we're pushing the feds very, very hard to try to give us guidance on an option that they put in the Affordable Care Act known as the Basic Health Plan. It was our intent and still is our intent to continue a Minnesota Care-like product through the financing mechanism of the Basic Health Plan, the BHP, as it were. And that is what we will be working on in subsequent bills. But this House File 5 does not speak to, at this point, whether or not there will be Minnesota Care funded through the BHP option at this point. That's work yet to be done. This is really the nuts and bolts of what the exchange will look like and how people will shop on an apples-to-apples basis to compare products available to them. And it would work whether or not we were successful in getting Minnesota Care continued under BHP funding.
Senator Gazalka. I'm sorry, Senator Westrum, are you finished? All right, Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Madam President. Will Senator Lori yield? I think he will. Senator Lori, I do have a question related to the premium tax. We've talked about that a little bit. You know that I've generally been opposed to that. We fought to take that out in the Commerce Committee. In the end, it did get taken out in the Tax Committee, where we had a different funding mechanism. And my concern has always been that we're passing on the expenses to those that are going to need the care, where the government's going to help, to a small number of people. And so my question related to that is I wanted to see, because we basically ended up adopting the House language, and I looked at the House fiscal note as far as what they estimate the premiums are going to be in Table 5 for individuals for health insurance. In 2014, it's $356, 2015, $317, 2016, $399. So $356 for an individual, average premium across all line or all ages. And my question is, when I look at what the average premiums are in the individual market today, instead of $356, they average between $180 to $200 for an average monthly premium for individuals. That's a fairly dramatic increase, and if that's the number that they're estimating for what they need for revenues coming in, can you assure me that the Commerce Department will approve rates that much higher in 2014, 15, and 16? Is that, if they can't, then I don't know that that's an accurate number, and therefore we're going to have false data coming in. So can you assure me that the Commerce Department will approve those rates at those high rates?
Senator Lori.
Madam President, Senator Gazalka, it's important to note that while there will be premium effects because of the Affordable Care Act, which is unavoidable, the Health Insurance Exchange itself, under this provision, does little to affect those premium results. But the premium effects by the Affordable Care Act are actually through buying value. We're getting a higher actuarial value, so we may be paying more in premiums, but we're paying less in cost sharing and point of service costs, and we're getting a better product that meets our needs in a much more robust manner. And it's also important to note that those premium effects are on the individual market, the small business and small group market. Gruber Gorman demonstrates will have no premium effects to speak of. And on the individual market, 70% of those purchasing individual products will be able to do so through the exchange, and they are under 400% of the federal poverty level. That's about $90,000 for a family of four. And for all of those individuals, the premium effects will be paid down by the federal tax subsidies and cost-sharing supports available to those families. And the net result is 70% of the individual market will experience no cost increases, and those that they do incur, and if you spread that across the entirety of the market, it yields a 34% reduction in healthcare premiums, and those that do occur will be able to be covered by those tax subsidies, and the Department of Commerce will still find any rate submitted that is actuarially sound and tied to the value of the product that you're getting. They will accept that rate.
Senator Gazelka.
Well, Madam President, members, part of what Senator Laurie said was that rates would go down, and part of what he said was rates were going to go up. I agree with the fact that rates are going to go up. If you're paying for your health insurance now, you're going to pay more. The estimates we saw were 29 to 50% more. And if you look at these premiums in the estimate on the tables from the House, I mean, they estimate them to be higher as well. Where I do not agree with Senator Laurie is that we are guaranteed to have a higher quality product. I have not seen that anywhere. I don't know how we're going to have a higher quality product than what we have right now. So in the end, we're going to pay more. We have less choices, and we're paying more.
Is there any more discussion on the amendment? Right. Roll call has been requested. Senator Westrom.
Madam President, Senator Laurie would yield.
Senator Laurie will yield. Senator Westrom.
Madam President, Senator Laurie, I understand the House had a provision that respected and protected life. Looks like we took some House provisions, but not that provision. Is there a reason we can't protect life, and is there any other language in here that would not cover abortions as part of the health plans that are being covered, and why couldn't we accept the House language on protecting life?
Senator Laurie.
Madam President, Senator Westrom, through 9 committees in a 12-hour floor debate, the matter never came up in the Senate. We didn't feel it was necessary. The Nelson Amendment adopted at the federal level precluded any federal funding running through the exchange from covering that legal procedure. We felt that was sufficient.
Okay, the motion, Senator Nenow.
Thank you, Madam President. Will Senator Laurie yield?
Senator Laurie will yield. Senator Nenow.
Senator Laurie, are there other provisions in this bill that never came before this Senate that we accepted from the House?
Senator Laurie.
The ones that we've discussed already, Madam President, Senator Nenow, yes.
Madam President.
Senator Nenow.
Another question for Senator Laurie.
Senator Laurie will yield. Senator Nenow.
Senator Laurie, are there provisions in this bill that the Senate expressly rejected?
Senator Laurie.
The financing mechanism was changed, and so in that sense, we rejected the financing mechanism of the withhold. But the House kept it all the way through. We passed all of our policy committees with that intact, so we passed on it several times. We had it changed in taxes. There was never an amendment to change it beyond that. So I suppose in one sense you could say that we had rejected it, but the House had a different financing mechanism. The function of a conference committee is to come up with a compromise that's acceptable to both bodies. I believe that that's what I've brought forward. And I don't know of others that we'd specifically rejected. Maybe Senator Nenow has something in mind. I'd be happy to think about it.
Well, Madam President, my point with that was Senator Laurie's explanation of not including the provision to which Senator Westrom asked about relative to abortion coverage was that it never came up in the Senate. My point with that is there are things in this bill that came through the House that never came before the Senate and we accepted. There are things in this bill that did come before this body and we rejected but are still in that bill. So I find that a very weak argument that simply because the Senate never looked at it, that it didn't make it into this bill.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam President. And with regard to purported support for the financing mechanism, because it went through policy committees, we were expressly asked to not discuss financing in our policy committees. And so I think that contention rings a bit hollow on the floor today.
Seeing no more discussion, the question before the body is the motion by Senator Benson that the recommendations and conference committee report on House File 5 be rejected and that the bill be re-referred to the conference committee as formerly constituted for further consideration. The secretary will take the roll. All members having voted, the
Madam
secretary.
President.
Madam President.
Madam President.
Madam President.
For what purpose does the gentleman, gentle lady, gentleman, say her hand?
Madam President, I believe we're under call, and I'm just curious to know who has been excused from
Senator voting. Goodwin and Senator Sparks have both been excused.
And are they're the only ones who have not voted?
Looks like it. Okay. The all members having voted, the secretary will close the roll. There being 31 in favor, 34 opposed, the motion does not prevail. The motion is defeated. Okay, we're back to Senator Lurie's motion that the conference committee report be approved, be adopted. Is there any more discussion? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, members, there was a saying that President Clinton said about the Affordable Care Act, and that was, you better get caught with your hands trying to fix it, or something like that. But you better be in the process of trying to fix this, and that's what I believe this body has tried to do, is fix this bill. We offered 13 amendments, over 40 amendments last week. 13 were adopted, but only 5 survived in the conference committee. And as far as the amendment coming from the House about abortion, there seems to be something in here with gun and firearm ownership on page 20, line 7, that we never discussed in this body. So I feel very sad about the portion of the House bill that was not adopted, and I want to just state that for the record. Something else that's very troubling that I stated last week, too, and worked on all through committee and worked with the author on this, too, is the authority and that there's no accountability. And the legislative oversight was something that Senator Lurie and I worked on together. I wanted to put some teeth into it. And obviously, there is no teeth. He basically emasculated the Oversight Commission with the language that was put in the conference committee. And that by saying, and this is on page 22, line 4, that a majority of the committee members appointed by the Senate and the majority of the committee members appointed by the House Well, members, that just takes the teeth out of any commission, and you know it's not going to go anywhere. And I'm extremely concerned about this, again, the most powerful board in the state of Minnesota, having no checks and balances, no boundaries, no ability for us to come back and say, what are you doing? How much money are you spending? And when it comes down to the spending, here we have a whole new funding mechanism, 1.5% withdrawal or withhold the first year, up to $20 million out of the general fund. And my question to that is, where is that $20 million coming out of? Is it going to be long-term care funding? Is it going to be the AMFIP population? Is it going to be the programs for our homeless youth? $20 million is a lot of money, members. And that with no checks and balances on this board, they can spend whatever they want and no oversight. I know, Senator Lurie, you put in some House language on the funds and reports on Section 9, page 20, that apparently must have come from the House. It looks like it's better. But again, they submit a budget to the legislature, but what are we supposed to do with it if we don't agree with it? That budget's already been in place. They've already requested the money from MMB, and away it goes. We have the right to stop this, and it won't be till the year after that we can stop this. So, as I said, members, you got four people that are running this board, running how healthcare is going to look like in the state of Minnesota, and it's very troubling to me. So, members, Senator Lurie, I know you've had the best intentions here, but again, I think we failed miserably on this, and I just want to say I'm sorry that we couldn't produce a better product.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam President. Colleagues, I want to follow up on what Senator Rosen was just talking about to begin with on the legislative oversight. Then I want to follow up regarding appeals and rules. I want to draw your attention to the legislative oversight proposition that's contained on page 22. And apparently that is the provision that the conferees felt would give some kind of comfort or oversight to the rulemaking process. But I want to bring to your attention that this legislative oversight committee is to be made up of certain members of the legislature, and will depend on whether or not we're in session as to whether or not they're going to figure out whether these rules have been properly promulgated. So if we're in session, what it says is that the board simply has to wait until the legislature has adjourned for the year, and then the rules become adopted. And if we're not in session, then they simply have to wait until the request has been satisfied, withdrawn, or February 1st occurs. And so they simply have to sit back and do nothing. And their rules that they have promulgated without any legislative oversight will in fact be adopted. Now, as to the appeals, and these are appeals of eligibility determination and grievances as they affect our constituents and as they affect health care providers. Now, initially, under Senate File 1, what was being proposed was a process whereby health care providers would be provided with a specific process of appeals under Chapter 14, the Administrative Procedures Act. And contained within that act, there are a number of protections which I went through the last time I was on the floor of the Senate talking about this. There was, however, in Senate File 1, a procedure which the board is going to come up with for purposes of allowing our constituents to appeal an adverse determination by the board. We had a fairly long discussion on the appeals process. I had asked that that the author adopt the same rules for our constituents that we are for healthcare providers, and that was rejected. However, what was adopted and accepted was a procedure under 256.045, which is a procedure that's accepted, and is contained within the Health and Human Services Division for something that's called a fair hearing. And we on the Senate floor accepted that somewhat reluctantly, but I will tell you at least there was some known process by which our constituents are going to be protected. As a result of the conference committee, that small amendment was stripped out, and this is what you are now left with in terms of an appeal process that will protect your constituents. First of all, this is new. The board may conduct hearings and appoint hearing officers. That was not in the bill before. This is new language. Number two, they retained the language in the conference committee that the board may establish a hearing process to provide for a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and that's where we had requested, and the amendment was accepted for the fair hearing under 256. The last thing that I want to bring to your attention is that, oddly enough, the fair hearing process that would protect our constituents that was stripped out of the bill remains in place for appeals to determination when a state agency has got some skin in the game under 256. So this bill, this conference committee, doesn't protect our constituents on an appeal, but it does, in fact, protect the state agencies. What our constituents are left with in terms of protecting their right of appeal when they have had an adverse decision made by the board is an unknown, untested process that is going to be created by a board that has not yet been formed and a board that has no accountability to our constituents, whereas the healthcare providers are going to be provided with a contested case proceedings under Chapter 14, which is a known and tested procedure. It has protections built into it to ensure that there are, in fact, fair hearings. And in my mind, this is at best a double standard for the protection of our constituents' legal processes, and at worst raises the question of an equal protection issue under our constitutional makeup. Next, I want to talk to you about rulemaking. In the original Senate File 1, under rulemaking, it provided that this board would have the ability to make what I'm going to call a super expedited rulemaking process. In Minnesota, under Chapter 14, we've got rulemaking with all kinds of protections and public notice. And then we have what's called an expedited rulemaking process in Chapter 14. And then they go to what I'm going to just characterize as super expedited rulemaking process, where there's almost no input on the part of the public. We had a long discussion on the Senate floor regarding that process and the fact that it isn't a safe, good process to implement. And so we offered an amendment, which was really quite simple. If the board is going to adopt a rulemaking under this super expedited process, at least we'll run the rule by an administrative law judge in accordance with Chapter 14 of the Administrative Procedures Act and find out whether or not, or get an opinion as to whether or not, the rule has been
properly created and follows the correct format in the state of Minnesota. And under the terms of the conference committee, that amendment, which would have only taken a period of 10 days, we agreed to 10 days, and that amendment was stripped out in the conference committee. So now we have nobody looking at this super expedited rule except the board members. Nobody's looking at it except the board members. What we have coming back now from the conference committee, in lieu of what we had passed off this floor, is even more onerous than what we were earlier considering when we talked about this last. This is what we now have in terms of rulemaking. This is new. I urge you to listen to this. If the board's policies, procedures, or other statements are rules as defined under the Administrative Procedures Act, the requirements of paragraph B or C are applicable. Now, paragraph B and C is the super expedited rulemaking process and the expedited rulemaking process. And what I want to bring to your attention is that what they're really talking about here is an unadopted rulemaking process that they have now stuck into this bill. The Administrative Procedures Act has a special protection built into it when a state agency takes a position of trying to enforce rules that have never been adopted. That's called unadopted rules. And what it says, and this is 14381, and what it says is that a person can petition the Office of Administrative Hearings and seek relief if an agency is enforcing or attempting to enforce policy, guidelines, bulletins, criteria, etc., as though it were a duly adopted rule. What we now have in the rulemaking process coming back from the conference report, page 15, line 30, if the board's policies, procedures, or other statements are not adopted. And so what we have now built in here is a way for the board to enforce policies, procedures, or other statements that are not adopted by rules, and we can't stop it because we're not subject to Chapter 14. The second thing that I want to bring to your attention is when we were talking about this super expedited rulemaking process before, we were dealing with a time frame from when the bill is enacted until January 1st, 2014. Conference committee comes back, they have now extended that deadline from 2014 to January 2015. They just picked up another year of super expedited rulemaking processes authorization from this legislature. And the super expedited rulemaking process to me really isn't a rulemaking process at all any longer under this bill. It's more like an executive edict because there aren't any real checks or balances. There's nobody else looking at these rules that this majority of four people in the state of Minnesota are able to adopt. So I would urge you to really consider the fact that I think what the conference committee has done is allowed the board to adopt unadopted rules and extended the time in which they can do it until the year 2015. Madam President, I have to say that I honestly do not understand why we as a legislative body are so willing to completely abdicate our constitutional responsibilities to our constituents and to the state of Minnesota, and why we are so willing to allow a board to undertake our responsibility to enact laws in the state of Minnesota. And that's exactly what this board is going to do. They are going to enact rules that carry the force of law that determine our constituents' legal rights. And why we are willing to do that is absolutely beyond me. So I will tell you that in this respect, I am somewhat happy that the modest amendments that have been removed from this bill that I had proposed, I'm almost happy that they are now gone, because I no longer have any fingerprints on this bill. And I will tell you, I am quite content to let anyone who wants to vote in favor of this bill to have all of the credit. And I am also very content to allow anyone that wants to vote in favor of this bill to take all of the blame. Thank you, Madam President.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise in support of a Minnesota Health Exchange, and I have been for a Minnesota Health Exchange since the beginning. And yet, when we went through the Senate process just a week or so ago, I voted against the final bill and now just voted to send it back to conference. And I did so because there are elements within the final conference report that I strongly disagree with. I strongly disagree with the active purchaser part of this. I believe that if we set forward criteria upon which products and providers and carriers hear that this is what we're looking for when it comes to price and offering and benefit set, then we owe it to those carriers to allow them to participate in the exchange. Yet I am mildly pleased that we made one concession with regard to that in the conference report, and that is the first year. So in the first year that the exchange is in existence, all of our carriers may put products and offerings on the exchange, and I think that is a first step. And I'm actually hopeful that in doing that, that we will begin to lay the groundwork for a different kind of process in the future. And I say that because I don't think this is the final step. I believe that we have tackled a sweeping piece of legislation, and that there, it's all right to come back at it if we think certain provisions we pass don't work. And so the active purchaser was one I felt strongly about. The other one that I feel very, very strongly about is the fact that our carrier community does not have, in my view, a seat at the table. And I think we in Minnesota have a long-standing tradition of including our carrier community as we've tackled health care reform. I remember years gone by when Senator Berglund would stand up and speak about the compromises that came forward by having the broadest group possible at the table. And I believe in that, and I believe that we are a divided Minnesota when we identify one group and, in essence, label them as not able to be an equal part of this discussion. And so I didn't think that that was in keeping with the values that I hold true when it comes to enacting legislation that has such impact on our entire provider community and carrier community. The Affordable Care Act, you know, is really a game changer. And many things that are included in that, while I think are important, like the no longer being able to have pre-existing conditions and making sure that everybody has insurance, those are very important provisions. They also bring a great deal of uncertainty to our carrier community in terms of their business model going forward. So anything we can do to make sure our carrier community, and I am proud as a Minnesotan that we're a nonprofit state, that our carrier community is in partnership with us, and for us to send a strong message to them that we appreciate their willingness to deal with these uncertain times as our partner. The way the conference committee report came back, that change was not made, and I'm disappointed. With regard to the fee structure, I'm concerned, particularly when I hear that the products, if the same product is offered in the exchange and outside of the exchange, then it's the same price, then to me, really, the premium withhold is a fee on all the products, and I would have preferred a different version than that. But at the end of the day, having voted no to the first bill and then no to or voting to send it back to conference, those were my opportunities to change the bill before us. At this point, I no longer have that opportunity. All I can do is decide, am I still for an exchange or am I not? And so I'm going to vote for this exchange, and I'm going to vote for the exchange because I think it's important that we continue this dialogue, that we stand strong for a Minnesota exchange, and then that we be open and willing to work with it as the process goes forward. And so I'll be watching closely. I'll be giving input. I certainly gave enough input in the week between the passing the bill off the Senate floor and the conference. I used every avenue available to try and exert influence, and again fell short in terms of my overall goals and objectives. But this is about something so much bigger. This is about a very large sweeping change in healthcare delivery. Cost side of things, we need to tackle and we need to do that together, and I'm hopeful that we will do that in partnership with all who are stakeholders in this important conversation. But for today, this is the bill that we have. This is the compromise that came forward out of the conference committee, and so because of that and my deep respect for this process, I will be supporting that conference committee report.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Lori yield?
Senator Lori, will you yield? Senator Lori will yield. Senator Brown.
Thank you. Senator Lori, last week on the floor of this chamber, I offered an amendment to your file that received strong bipartisan support and it passed. And that was an amendment that would have required legislators to purchase their health insurance, their individual health insurance, through the exchange. Senator Lori, did this amendment make it into the final bill?
Senator Lori.
Madam President, Senator Brown, it did not. I believe Senator Benson was the one that already asked me about that. And in looking at it with the House, they were not very amenable to this. We would not be able to receive premium tax credits or cost-sharing reductions from the feds, and it could greatly increase the cost of health care for legislators, and it did not seem a wise amendment.
Senator Brown.
Madam President, Senator Lori, did this amendment receive any discussion in the conference committee?
Senator Lori.
Yes, I do believe we discussed this in the conference committee. I don't, you know, the days become a little bit of a blur. I don't remember the exact time, but we did discuss this in conference committee, and the House indicated they would not be amenable to accepting it.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Lori, could you give me a brief overview of what that discussion sounded like in conference committee on this amendment?
Senator Lori.
I believe I did. It does not appear that this would meet with federal standards regarding plans offered through the exchange that would be able to receive advanced premium tax credits or cost-sharing reductions, and with that, the House indicated they would not be amenable to this. We did not move it as an amendment, given the House's position.
Senator Brown.
Madam President, I find it rather ironic that once again that some of us in this body are creating laws that we are willing to impose upon others in Minnesota, but we ourselves as legislators are not willing to live under. This amendment passed through this body with strong bipartisan support, but yet the conference committee wasn't willing to put it into the final bill because evidently the conference committee members know something that the rest of Minnesota is going to find out about this exchange. And that is, it's not good legislation for Minnesota. Whether or not I receive subsidies for my insurance through this exchange is not important to me. Right now, as legislators, we pay nothing toward our monthly premium for our health insurance through the state. So the fact that we would have to start paying something for our health insurance through the exchange, to me, is a good idea. And once again, I cannot support this bill if we, as legislators, are not willing to live under the laws that we're imposing upon others. My parents always used a phrase when I was growing up, and that is, actions speak louder than words. Well, members, today, our actions are speaking much louder than any excuses, any words we have as to why legislators should not be required to get their insurance through the exchange. Whatever excuses are offered, whatever debate is offered today, the fact is our actions speak louder than those words, and our actions are saying, this is good for the rest of Minnesota, but we as legislators do not want to be a part of it.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam President. We've worked hard to have an online Minnesota-made exchange. We're known for having the best health care in the world, the lowest cost, and the best outcomes. So we should be having a Minnesota exchange, a Minnesota-made exchange. But it pains me today to realize that all the amendments that we offered, the letter to the conferees, that multitudes of bipartisan senators sent to the conferees asking to make sure that consumer choice was in the marketplace. Those amendments have not only been rejected, the conference committee that came back further limited consumer choice. So now, not only is consumer choice limited in the exchange, with the language that came back on page 13, subdivision 4, now the government is reaching its tentacles into plans that are offered outside the exchange. This is a dangerous direction for Minnesotans and Minnesotans' health care. I'm disappointed that the conference committee has actually come back with a bill that further limits patient choice. Not only that, the very experts that could help in the science of health care delivery have been excluded from the board. So while this bill calls for, in section 5 on page 3 of Senator Lori's bill, it talks about the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace Establishment, and it's created to promote informed consumer choice. Members, the bill you're going to be voting on today does not promote consumer choice. It magnifies government choice. The bill before us is magnifying the role of government choice. This bill is supposed to provide competition. It does just the opposite. It eliminates competition. And so while I am going to vote against this bill, I fear that it's still going to pass this body, even though it is not in the best interest of Minnesotans' health care. And so now we need to turn our attention to the Minnesota Marketplace rules, which are yet to be developed. We need to make sure that those rules make sure that every Minnesotan enrolled in the exchange or outside the exchange is able to get the right care that they need. That could be the primary physician down the road. It could be the tertiary specialty care offered in my district. But we must ensure that Minnesotans have the ability to get the right care at the right time. That will be our next challenge. But the bill before us today will further increase government choice, limit consumer choice, And according to the bill, it's supposed to help make health insurance more affordable, but there's nothing in this bill that will make it more affordable. What we're seeing is a 3.5% tax on the premiums. That's an increase in health care cost. And while one might think that the conferee report that came back and said that we will not limit competition in the first year of the exchange, if you understand how much it costs to bring an insurance product to market in a very small state, a state with a small population like Minnesotans, this is no concession. There's not an insurance company that can bring a product to market for 1 year and not knowing that in the years two and beyond, that if they play by all the rules designed by this unelected board, they can have their product on the market. No, this does not increase choice at all. So while I'm disappointed our work was not heeded in increasing consumer choice, I'll continue to work on the insurance marketplace rules that will allow Minnesotans to make sure that Minnesotans get the right care at the right time.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm going to urge members to reject the conference committee report. The Minnesota marketplace is anything but a marketplace. A 7-member board has even more power than it did when it left here. It has even more power to limit consumer choice and limit access to care, and it's harder for us to hold them accountable under this conference committee report than in the bill we passed off this floor. We know that our costs are going to go up because of the 3.5% tax. And while the goal of the ACA and the exchange is purportedly to reduce the amount of uninsured in Minnesota, we will be spending $60 million a year, members, and we will still have 300,000 Minnesotans uninsured. We'll be subject to more Washington rules. And a 7-member board will set policy that belongs rightfully in this body. I'm going to urge you to vote no so that we can work together to protect Minnesota choices, quality, and cost containment in our healthcare system, members.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you. Members, this bill is a disgrace. And I'm really confused a little bit about the way this bill has progressed, because we heard a lot of rhetoric in the last few months from the party on the other side of the aisle about how important it is that we work together, that we have bipartisanship in the things that we do. And here, this is the most significant piece of legislation so far this year, and some have said the most significant piece of healthcare legislation in 50 years. And at the federal level, the ACA, the Obamacare legislation, was passed in an extremely partisan fashion. We all know that. And it remains unpopular among the broad public. It's still not supported by a majority of Americans. And here in this state, to take a piece of that legislation that we are supposed to enact, an exchange, and to do it in the way that it is being done, I think is a disgrace. This would have been the easiest bill to have bipartisan support on, and everybody in this room knows it. There are a number of people on our side of the aisle, Republicans, who would have supported an exchange bill that would have made some concessions to a marketplace. And we know it. And there are people outside of this room who would have been willing to stand up with you and the governor and said, we support a Minnesota marketplace that is truly a marketplace. And we all know that as well. But this bill does not do that. And why? You have rejected every attempt to go in that direction is something that is still a mystery to me. There is no support for this bill beyond the DFL caucus and its political allies. And I still have to ponder that. What does that mean? We're talking about doing something for the interests of the people of the state of Minnesota, for the betterment of the people of the state of Minnesota, not for the DFL party, not for the DFL constituencies, but for the people of the state of Minnesota. And yet there is no support for this bill beyond the DFL caucus and its political allies. And that was intentional, because we all know that there could have been broader support for this bill with a few concessions from the other side. And there were attempts for those concessions to be offered in the form of amendments, and they were all rejected. every single one of them. And we've heard a few of the discussions today on what those things could have done. We talked about choice, how important it is to have consumer choice in insurance, and to follow the federal ACA laws, allow all the plans that are eligible to be on this in this exchange marketplace. But no, what the Democrats have said is we want to make sure that only the best plans, only the ones that these four members of this board decide are the best plans for Minnesota, are the ones that you have to choose from. Because we know what's best for you, you should not be free, people of Minnesota, to decide which health care plan is right for you. We should let these four unelected, unaccountable, insulated members of a board decide which plans are right for you, and those are the ones that you should have the choice of, not all the other plans that are out there in the marketplace. We are going to dictate what that marketplace looks like. That's what choice means, I guess, to the DFL. Limiting the number of options you have, that's what choice means. We talked about the cost. We talked about how much this exchange is. We already know we've spent $100 million of money building this thing, planning for it. We're now talking about spending another $50, $60, $70 million a year to operate it. Utah has an exchange. They're spending, $15, $20 million a year to operate their exchange, if that. But we're going to spend three times that amount. And we've talked about how we're going to do that. Raising the premium costs, and Senator Lori tried to explain to us how that was going to work, and it's not just going to happen on the premiums of plans inside the exchange, but also insurance outside the exchange. It was a very convoluted explanation, but the bottom line is everybody's cost is going to go up because of this exchange. And what he tried to tell us is that, well, there are costs, and we know there are. When you put together a marketing plan, whatever it is, an exchange or anything else, whatever you call it, there are costs to do it. And when companies do those things, they do it because they know there's a benefit, that they'll get something in return. They'll see their business go up. They'll see their profits rise. They'll see something of benefit to them. Now, you would think that if there was a benefit to this plan, the insurance plans in this state would be supporting it, but they're not. And so it rings hollow to say that these costs are going to be a benefit to the consumers. They are not. They're just going to drive up all the costs for all of our policies, all of our insurance across the state. And then we talk about, well, we all know that the premiums are going to go up because the federal law requires that we're going to have to cover more things and do it in a more costly way. But don't worry, because the federal government is going to come in with a big subsidy and buy down those higher costs for some of us. So we're going to have a shift in cost. The costs are going to go up, but we're going to have a shift to pay them off. Or is that a gimmick? I'm not sure if it's a shift or a gimmick. Maybe it's a shifty gimmick. But that's what we're going to do. We're going to raise the cost of insurance and then plan on the federal government, that body that has so much money, so much extra money, is going to come in and buy down those premiums so that we can all say we're getting a better deal on insurance. Members, this bill is a disgrace, and we should reject it. If you care about consumer choice, you should reject this bill. If you care about accountability and how we govern these kinds of things, as was pointed out, you should reject this bill. If you care at all about what a free market is, you should reject this bill. If you care about fiscal responsibility, you should reject this bill. If you care about having Minnesota have the ability to make laws and govern our own state with matters of health care and insurance, you should reject this bill. And if you believe that we are free citizens and we have the right to make decisions about our own health care, you should reject this bill. Members, vote no.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we listened to all the speeches around here. You'd be sure the sky is falling. We finally get a plan that will hopefully give access to a lot more Minnesotans and hopefully at a better price. We've done nothing significant on health care for a very long time. And I'd like to ask if Senator Han would yield.
Will Senator Han yield? He will yield. Senator Goodwin.
Senator Han, you were the chair of the Health and Human Service Committee in the last 2 years under Republican control of the Senate. And I know that Senator Lurie asked you several times to start hearing this issue in your committee. And I know that was refused. So if you're so concerned that this isn't the right kind of bill, why weren't you willing to work together with Democrats in the last 2 years to start working on this bill?
Senator Han.
We did have a hearing on a bill that Senator Lori said came from the Healthcare Exchange Task Force. We did hear that bill in our committee. And it seems clear, given the direction that this bill has taken, that the Democrats and the governor had in mind a version of an exchange that was simply the bill that we have in front of us. And so while it is true that there are members in our caucus who support an exchange of various kinds, and some of us don't support an exchange, don't think it's necessary, and did offer other alternatives to solving the problem of higher insurance costs, I think it's pretty clear that if you're going to go down the path of an exchange with the governor that we have today, that this is the bill that we're going to end up with, the one we have today. And we do not have bipartisan support on this bill. And there was no effort to secure bipartisan support on this bill. And so if the Democrats really believe that it's important to have bipartisan support on a bill as important as this, it would have been very easy to get it, and everybody in this room knows it.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. And earlier there was discussion about the amendment, about the provision that was in the bill that said that legislators should be in the exchange as well. Well, I introduced an amendment 2 years ago that would say that legislators had to accept the plan that Senator Hahn was trying to sell to us that would have cut a lot of Minnesotans and did, in fact, lower eligibility and cut a lot of people off of health care. And but we were being told it was just this wonderful new plan, and yet when I introduced an amendment to put us in there, I think every single Republican voted against that. In fact, I think it only got 16 votes total out of this body. So I don't think that's really a real issue here, whether or not legislators are in this bill or not. It certainly is not something that you wanted with your wonderful plan 2 years ago. So let's be fair about this. The sky isn't falling. Let's give this a chance to work out, and we can always make modifications if everything doesn't go just perfectly. And take a look again at the MCHA board, and somebody handed out the list of who's on the MCHA board, one of the Republicans did last week, and what we found was that the industry controls almost every seat on the board for MCHA. That's not exactly the best plan for Minnesotans, because it's so expensive that if you already have a condition that you're excluded from other health insurance, you can still barely afford. Most people can't afford to pay the MCHA premiums. So let's look at this realistically, and let's just vote this bill up and make sure that we give Minnesotans some choice in health care.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam President and members. What we have before us in House File 5 is a compromise between the House positions and the Senate positions, which did differ in significant regards. And we got to work, and we worked hard, and I think we came out with a bill that can move Minnesota forward and that can meet the broad goals of making it a health insurance exchange that can work for industry and, at the end of the day, has the backs of the people of Minnesota as well. We have a conflict-free board that's able to ensure that the products offered inside the exchange are in the interest of consumers. That's a critical component of this bill, to make sure that we get better deals for our individuals, for our families, and for our small businesses. There is indeed significant accountability and oversight that was actually strengthened within this process. We strengthened the OLA oversight, a trusted, nonpartisan entity within the state of Minnesota. There's significant federal oversight of every exchange. There's significant legislative oversight. And despite what we've heard here, this legislative oversight committee is empowered to take a good look at those rules and slow them down with enough time for the legislature to act should they see fit if this exchange board is doing something other than what we are expecting of them. Let's look at the plus side of some of what we have in front of us here. When we get this up and running and we have guaranteed issue and no pre-existing conditions and retro benefits, we are going to be able to do away with the MCHA assessments that fall on businesses today. That's over $160 million worth of assessments that employers and businesses pay today. That's a direct offset against premiums. The Department of Health has done a study we will be eliminating $150 million worth of uncompensated care costs borne by our provider network across the state, most of which gets cost allocated back to those of us who are insured, largely through the fully insured market. Some of it, of course, goes to the self-insured and the large employers, but they're protected by a really strong ability to negotiate for the best deals on behalf of their consumers. We're working to make sure that defined contribution plans, where small businesses are able to cap what they will provide in terms of health insurance for their employees, are able to be sold on this market and able to be really become a viable part of our business. And to Senator Bonhoff's point about this being a starting place, she's absolutely right. This is just one piece. I understand this is a cornerstone of the Federal Affordable Care Act, and it's been a matter of some controversy for all 3 years that it's been in existence, but I'm proud to be standing up here on the Senate floor today proposing a bill that'll move us forward on the exchange. This is largely health insurance reform, and it's a foundation upon which to make sure that people have access to the care that they need. And I fully expect and look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisles and with our business community to make sure that our carriers understand the criteria that they're going to be held to make these the plans that they offer in the interest of consumers, and they get their plans offered on this exchange. Just that they're better plans and that they meet people's needs better than what people have today. We're going to work together, members. This is going to be step one. It's insurance reform. We have a long way to go to bringing about the triple aims of healthcare reform, which is to improve the individual experiences of people when they're interacting with our healthcare system, to improve population-based health, and through doing those first two well, we will bend the cost curve, which is the third of the triple aims. And with that, members, I would encourage a green vote in support of House File 5. Thank you.
The motion for the body is to adopt the conference committee report. A roll call has been requested. There be no further discussion. The secretary will take the roll. All members having voted, the secretary will close the roll. There being 39 ayes and 28 nays, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The report is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, the Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
House File Number 5, a bill for an act relating to commerce, establishing the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, prescribing its powers and duties, etc.
Seeing no further discussion, the Secretary will take the roll on House File 5. All members having voted, the Secretary will close the roll. There being 39 ayes and 28 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. We move now to the fifth order of business, reports of committees. Senator Bach.
Madam President, I move that the committee reports printed in the agenda and the addendum be adopted.
All those in favor?
Madam President.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam President, pursuant to Rule 21, I object to the reference of Senate File 458.
That is noted, and that bill will be referred to the Committee on Rules. On the rest of the bills on the motion, all those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The sixth order of business is the second reading of Senate bills. The bills printed on the agenda and in the addendum will be given their second reading. Whoops. With the exception of Senate File 458. All those in favor of that motion say aye. That is second reading. Eighth order of business, introduction and first reading of Senate bills. The bills as printed on the agenda will be referred as indicated and given their first reading. The ninth order of business, these are author motions, and they'll be offered as one motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Cohen.
Madam President, I move that Senate File 720 be withdrawn from the Committee on Education and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
This is your bill?
I believe this is the...
This is your bill?
Yes, it is.
And this is, you've spoken to the Education Chair?
I believe the Education Chair is aware of it, yes.
Yes. All those in favor of the Cohen motion say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 1311 be withdrawn from the Committee on Jobs, Agriculture, Rural Development and returned back to me.
This is your bill?
This is my bill.
All those in favor of that motion say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Bach.
Madam President, Senate File 1320 is mine, and I no longer need to have it considered, so I'd like it returned to me.
Senator Bach moves that Senate File 1320 be withdrawn from the Committee on State and Local Government and re-referred to the and returned to its author. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The Senate Resolution 47 and 48 will be referred to the Rules Committee. Senator Bach.
Madam President, pursuant to Rule 26, I designate the following bill to be made a special order for immediate consideration. Number one on general orders, Senate File 359. And I would yield to Senator Pappas.
Senator Bach, it's number 61 on general orders.
I think that's what I said.
You said one.
Oh, I meant to say 61,
Madam President. I knew you meant to say 61. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam President. Senate File 359 would designate that the month of April would become Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month in recognition of the state's desire to combat all acts of genocide and all human rights atrocities. Members, the state of Minnesota has a history of standing up against genocide. In 2007, Governor Pawlenty signed into law a bill that divested our state public pension funds from companies that were directly or indirectly funding the genocide in Darfur. A resolution was unanimously passed in the House and Senate declaring April 2011 to be Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. And in April 2012, we received a certificate of recognition from Governor Dayton recognizing efforts to educate the public about genocide and to commemorate the victims of genocide. I hope today to make this recognition permanent through passage of this bill. April has been chosen for this important designation, like three other states, the states of California, Texas, and Georgia, because it's a month in which the anniversaries of six of these tragedies occur. April 3rd was the Darfur genocide commemoration. April 5th is the anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo, Bosnia. April 7th, the Rwanda genocide remembrance day. April 8th is Holocaust remembrance day. April 17th is the anniversary of the Cambodian genocide. And April 24th is Armenian genocide remembrance day. Members, I would greatly appreciate your support for this very important declaration. Thank you.
Discussion on Senate File 359. Third reading, Senate File 359.
Want me to read it?
Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
Senate File Number 359, a bill for an act relating to state government, designating the month of April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month.
Third reading. Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 359. Members will please vote. Secretary will close the roll. There being 66 ayes and one nay, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Announcements of Senate interest. Without objection, the following senators will be excused from today's session. Senator Goodwin, 10 a.m. to 11:50 a.m. Senator Sparks from 10 a.m. to 11:55 a.m. Are there other announcements? Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam President, the Health and Human Services and Housing Committee will meet at 12:45 in room 15. Please be on time.
Other announcements?
Madam President.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam President, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division will meet in 10 minutes at 1:45. We meet after session adjourns.
Senator Metzen.
Madam President, the Commerce Committee will meet at 12:45.
Senator Sieben.
Madam President, the Subcommittee on Elections will meet as soon as we have a quorum.
Are there any other announcements of Senate interest? Seeing none, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam President. I move the Senate do not adjourn until Wednesday, March 20th, 11 a.m.
On that motion, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate is adjourned.